The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
We are honored to have her with us tonight. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Annie Leibovitz.
Philadelphia. Pennsylvania didn't let us down. Yeah. Ooh. I've been traveling the country, and it's been fun. I mean, I was in Chicago two nights ago, and that place is like the center of the universe right now. And all I have to do is say the word Obama, and the crowd goes, "Rawr!" You know, so every 10 minutes or so, I'll say the word Obama, and I'll see if... You're still awake. I haven't really talked much about my work, before, and I really never have. And the truth is, I never talked much at all. I know it's hard to believe, but it's been a journey to find a voice. And Susan Sontag used to help me with my speeches. And occasional statements that had to be made, but that had its drawbacks. My John and Yoko picture, the one with him naked, had been taken out of a show in Los Angeles, and I don't remember the circumstances, but I was asked to make a statement and about how I felt about this, and I asked Susan what I should do, and she dashed off a few lines about censorship in America today. You know, she always loved to fight the good fight, and well. The next day, I got a call from the LA Times asking me to write the op-ed piece for the editorial pages of that Sunday paper. And for a moment, I thought, oh, yeah, well, anyway. I didn't think a photographer's life needed words. It was such a milestone for me. It was a rite of passage, that book. With the personal work and the assignment work combined, but I was talked into doing it, and Sharon Delano, who's a good friend of Susan's and mine, and also was an editor at the New Yorker, I sat down with her and did a series of conversations, and she took that material and wrote the introduction to Photographer's Life. So that was. It's the closest that I've ever come to what I imagine my voice is, inside my head. So I, the one in my mind, my real voice. So I always wanted to do a little book about where I would explain how my pictures were made. Something, I could use if I ever get a chance to teach. And I imagined at the beginning that this book was going to take 10 photographs and dissect them and go into them in depth and explore, talk about how they were thought of and made and walk through the whole process. And I talked Random House into putting this book in the four-book contract that I had with him. It was going to be a little book. I said, it was going to be, because I didn't really think I could write, I could say very much. So I said, it's going to be 40 pages and, it's going to be about 10 pictures. Well, the book, of course, Sharon and I sat down to work this way again, and the book turned into 240 pages and over 100 photographs. So tonight I'm going to read from this book and show you the pictures and talk a little bit about it. This is one of the cities I was in. They said, someone at the end said, is that your daughter's writing on the... under the picture, and does anyone know? Can anyone guess whose writing that is? Mine. Mine's better. Mine's better than that.
Jerry Winograd.
No. David Hockney. Got it. Well, good. And you get a door prize at the end. should give the book away. So the book is dedicated to my family, my first subjects, and the people who put up with me. There's a section in the back of the book about... Sharon and I decided to do this. I had this idea. Let's answer every question. Let's try to, with this book, answer every question that's ever been asked. So in the back of the book, there's actually the 10 most asked questions. Of course, since I've been on this book tour, I think I can add about 10 more to that list. I'm going to read a little bit from one of those questions in the back about what advice do I have for a young photographer just starting out. This is my father on the left and my mother on the right. And my father didn't talk to me too much, but every time he was taking me to the airport, that's when he would start talking to me about, you know, maybe you should get a real job. And, and my mother was very prolific with, home movies and photographs of all the kids. So I've said about a million times that the best thing a young photographer can do is to stay close to home. Start with your friends and family, the people who will put up with you. Discover what it means to be close to your work, to be intimate with the subject. Measure the difference between that and working with someone you don't know as much about. Now, of course, there are many good photographs that have nothing to do with staying close to home, and I guess what I'm really saying is that you should take pictures of something that means something to you. When I was a young photographer at Rolling Stone, I learned that what I did mattered. This may have been because I was published, but whether you're published or not, you have to care about what you do. You might even seem to be obsessive about it. The next chapter in the book is actually about the making of the Nixon resignation photograph. And as I started to talk to Sharon about the making of this picture, it turned into more of a chapter about the writers I've worked with my years at Rolling Stone, and then I like to lovingly call it, why I don't work with writers anymore. But Rolling Stone was never just the music magazine. It was about the culture around the music, and by the time I arrived there, more political stories were being assigned. It was hard to avoid politics in the early 70s in San Francisco. It was a politically charged place. Hunter Thompson showed up at Rolling Stone about the same time I did. He came to the office with a six-pack of beer to pitch a story about running for sheriff in Aspen on the freak power ticket. Hunter was inventing gonzo journalism. He was very charismatic, and on some level, I was in love with him. Well, everyone was in love with Hunter, so I just jumped in the car and went along with him for a while. Hunter got his stories by sitting in bars and talking to people, and half the time his sources didn't know he was reporting. The only time I remember him asking me to pick up my camera was one beautiful moonlit night when we were driving north on Highway 1 with no headlights on. A policeman stopped us, and when he started to give Hunter a sobriety test, Hunter pulled me out of the car and told me to take pictures. The policeman let us go. Well, Hunter seemed totally nuts to me, but I was young and inexperienced, and he was seasoned. He skipped the traditional ways of gathering information and understood on a larger scale what was important. He broke the mold on how to gather information and write. He taught me that good reporters don't travel in packs, and as crazed as he was, he knew what he was doing. Hunter never talked to me about the stories we were working on. He pushed me away, and by pushing me away, he forced me to look at things myself. Hunter helped teach me how to see. On one level, Tom Wolfe operated very much like Hunter did, but Tom wasn't at all like Hunter temperamentally. Tom was a gentleman, very proper. He always wore long-sleeve shirts, and even if it was 95 degrees out and 100% humidity, he never sweated. Everyone was sweating through their clothes, and Tom was completely dry. I'm talking about the launch site of Cape Kennedy, where I went with Tom Wolfe, where he started to do his work on the right stuff. So Hunter sweated a lot, and when he wasn't sweating, he was screaming that he wasn't sweating, and he thought he was dying.
And then I go into a little bit about the about being at the launch site and how intimidating it was, because I went with you know, I was working for this little magazine, Rolling Stone, and this little fold-up magazine, and I was one photographer with, you know, at that time I just had, you know, two cameras and a couple lenses. So I was there with one camera, and all the other photographers were working in teams with 16 cameras and tripods and long lenses. They had a lot of stuff. I couldn't decide on the most fundamental thing, which was whether to photograph the people's faces as the rocket ship went up or the rocket itself. I pretty much decided not to shoot the liftoff because everyone else was going to do that, but when it actually occurred, I couldn't help but turn around and take the picture. You don't realize how powerful the sound is. It travels in waves. The whole experience is very humbling. I found myself crying and holding on to the person next to me, whoever he was. Nixon's resignation was the last story I worked on with Hunter, and when Nixon came out to California in the summer of 1974, in the middle of the Watergate scandal, Hunter and I were invited to a strange cocktail party for the press at San Clemente. Well, Hunter gave me some mescaline. I took mescaline only a couple times in my life, but when you're with Hunter, in Hunter's world, you did what he did. So I was taking pictures because it seemed like the thing to do, and I couldn't understand why people were looking at me sort of strangely. Ron Ziegler, Nixon's press secretary, was wearing shorts, and there was a banner on the wall that read, "Hang in there, Mr. President." 2 weeks later, we were in Washington to cover the end. I had been one of the last journalists to be given credentials to get into the White House, and Hunter was back at the hotel. Every reporter on the planet was at the White House, and Hunter was in a swimming pool at the Hilton with a battery-powered TV set. When Nixon walked down the red carpet toward the helicopter that would take him away, there were dozens of press photographers. Everyone pretty much moved away after Nixon was inside the helicopter and the door was closed. The guards began rolling up the carpet. It wasn't the kind of picture that most magazines would want to run or had room to run then, but a lot can be told in those moments in between the main moments. So Hunter never, you know, filed the story in time. The magazine, Rolling Stone, had like these 8 blank pages, and so they just blew up my pictures. It was one of my first big major photo spreads in the magazine. This next section is on the Rolling Stones tour, and you know, it's funny about coming to Philadelphia, because when I think of Philadelphia, I think, you know, all those years at Rolling Stone magazine, that when you were on the road with some of these bands, their best shows were here in Philadelphia, because they would leave New York, they'd be so glad to get out of New York, that when they came to Philadelphia, and I remember the Rolling Stone show here, I remember I was actually, I was a little jaded at that point, and I was in the back, dressing rooms, and I turned to Lisa Robinson, and I could hear the music, and I said, "My God, they really sound good," we ran out to the front, and it was like one of the best shows I'd ever seen the Rolling Stones do was here in Philadelphia. But this chapter is really about being on the road with this band of men, and at that time, I was very young. I thought that as a photographer, you were supposed to lose yourself and into what you were doing and sort of camouflage, like become one with what you were doing to take the best pictures. And this is a story really about holding on to yourself, take care of yourself, and don't give yourself completely away like that. And it was sort of funny because I was so naive and so young. When I started the tour, I looked at the roster of hotels that the band was staying in, and I said, "Well, these are pretty good hotels. Maybe I'm going to bring my tennis racket along, and I'll take a lesson from the pro, in my spare time, and brush up on my tennis." And of course, after the first concert, I never saw the light of day again. When I first worked for Rolling Stone, we'd pretty much wait until a band came to town, and that's when you would take the pictures. I hardly ever traveled. But in 1972, Jan said it was okay if I went along to 2 or 3 cities with the Rolling Stones. Robert Frank was traveling with the band, making a 16-millimeter film that would become Cocksucker's Blues. The band had commissioned him to do to do it, but it was never formally released, presumably because of the drugs and sex that were filmed. I was in awe of Robert Frank. Here was the great master. I couldn't believe that I was able to watch him work for a few days, that I was actually in the room where Robert Frank was loading his camera. He picked up my camera once. I was terrified. He held it. It was like being with God. He said to me, "You can't get every picture." Well, that was comforting advice. You do miss things. You're attached to this machine, to its timing. And, of course, Robert Frank didn't seem to be missing anything. A rock and roll tour is unnatural. You're moving through time and space too fast. The experience is extreme. There is the bigness of the performances and then the isolation and loneliness to follow. The band was like a group of lost boys, but their music saved them. It gave them a reason to exist. And I learned about power on that tour, about how people in an audience can lose a sense of themselves and melt into a frenzied, mindless mass. Mick and Keith had tremendous power both on stage and off. They would walk into a room like young gods. I found that my proximity to them lent me power also, a new kind of status. It didn't have anything to do with my work. It was power by association. I've been on many tour buses and at many concerts, but the best photographs I've made of musicians at work were done during that Rolling Stones tour. I probably spent more time on it than on any other subject. For me, the story about the pictures is about almost losing myself and coming back and what it means to be deeply involved in a subject. The thing that saved me was that I had my camera by my side. It was there to remind me who I was and what I did. It separated me from them. This is a photograph that was taken towards the end of the tour of Mick going up in the elevator. It was toward the end of the tour, and he was not on the ground. He was flying from another world. He was the most beautiful object, like a butterfly, ethereal. After all that time on the road, his dancing was very, very loose. It was almost surreal. I was always aware of where Mick was, and what might have seemed like a nuisance to him became a source of comfort. It was a subject-photographer relationship of an obsessive kind. In the book, there's a section on the making of the John and Yoko picture, which I'll just say tonight, you know, that I talk about how it was a picture that was, you know, didn't happen. It wasn't a quick idea. It was something that happened, you know, it was almost 10 years in the making, having photographed John and Yoko 10 years earlier. And then there's a section on conceptual pictures. And this is Robert Penn Warren and Tess Gallagher. And I talk about eight of the conceptual pictures that were taken like late 70s, early 80s. When I was just sort of finding my way with this conceptual idea, and it sort of explains how they came about. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Tess Gallagher. I'll read a little bit about the Tess Gallagher. The portrait of Tess Gallagher and the one of Robert Penn Warren are from a series of poets I made for Life magazine in 1980. Tess Gallagher wrote about horses. She showed me a home movie she had shot on horseback. There were masks all over her house and coat racks full of clothes. She wanted to get dressed up, and she pulled the sequin dress out of her closet. When you were with Gallagher, you were in her world, and you could see the way her imagination worked. The Tess Gallagher portrait is the beginning of placing my subject in the middle of an idea. Somewhere in the raw material was the nucleus of what the picture would become. It didn't have to be a big idea. It could be simple. There's a case to be made that the simpler the idea, the better. And then in this series, in this chapter, I discuss all of these photographs. The Bette Midler picture, Meryl Streep, Belushi and Ackroyd, Blues Brothers, Steve Martin, Whoopi in the Bathtub, Keith Haring. I talk about everything in this book that I've had a chance to do, and I talk a little bit about advertising. I thought it was important. The book is sort of directed to young photographers and someone who might be interested in doing something like what I do. And I wanted to come clean and talk about the advertising a little bit. And this is John Cleese, and this was done for the America's Best Portrait campaign. I talk a little bit about how advertising really, you know, it wasn't natural to me. It didn't come, you know, it wasn't something that I really wanted to do. In fact, the first 15 years of my work, I didn't do any advertising. I was quite proud of that, you know, coming from a fine art school. But when I was working in New York, and I started to work for Vanity Fair, they weren't using me much, and Irving Penn was doing most of the covers. And Ruth Ansell, who was the art director of Vanity Fair, you know, said that, you know, I should be doing advertising. And you know, if you're a professional photographer in New York, she would say to me that you should be, you know, 25% of your work should be advertising. So you know, I did try. I remember doing a favor for Sissy Spacek by doing her album cover for an album of country music she made after she did Coal Miner's Daughter, and I was miserable because I realized that for the first time that I had to please her, and I thought that I should, and that really threw me. So and I think I even gave her the money back, you know, because it was too hard. But in 1986, there was an art director with Ogilvy & Mather, Perry Merkley, approached me and said that you know, he was working on this campaign for the American Express portrait idea, and he told me that I would have complete freedom to do whatever I want. And it was hard to believe, but he was very persistent. And I talk a little, and I write a little bit about that, and I'll read that now. The American Express shoots were more elaborate productions than I'd been involved with before, with much larger budgets. The magazines were pretty tight with money, but American Express was a different beast. Suddenly, I was spending money like I'd never spent money before. I would fly to Detroit to shoot Elmore Leonard, and it would be snowing. And I'd say, you know, what I don't really want to shoot here today, so why don't we go to Florida? And we'd go to Florida. You don't do that on a magazine budget. It was great. Money affected my relationships with the subjects also. They were being paid, and they suddenly were very cooperative, even friendly. I learned so much on that campaign. It was a great way to experiment and explore ideas. American Express gave me a larger canvas to work on than I had ever had before. And there was a personal benefit. I didn't have a very good credit rating after all those years at Rolling Stone. I'd applied for an American Express card and been rejected several times. I operated with cash, and the agency found out about this when I left several thousand dollars in an envelope in a phone booth while I was on a shoot. So strings were pulled, and I finally got my card. This is a little story about the making of this photograph with Al Sharpton. You know, just to sort of keep your eyes and ears open when you work. Basically, I was shooting Al Sharpton for Vanity Fair, and his office called and said he was going to be a couple hours late. And I said, "Oh, really? Is everything okay?" And I said, "No, it's fine. He's just going to get his hair done. You know, he'll meet you in a couple hours." And I said, "Well, could I meet him at the beauty? Could I meet him at the, you know, where he's getting hair done?" And they said, "Sure, that's fine." And it was the Prima Donna Beauty Care Center in Brooklyn, and I would have done it just for the caption, actually. But, I asked them. It was funny. At the end of one of my talks, at the question period, someone asked me, "How did I get Al Sharpton to do that?" And I said, "Well, it was, you know, it wasn't very hard. I mean, there was no problem here. I just asked him. I mean, it was." In fact, he went ahead and called the Post after I left, and they came and took his picture, and it appeared in the Post the next day, and Vanity Fair never ran the picture. This next section is You know, I've been doing this for almost 40 years now. And there are some people that I've, you know, followed their careers and photographed them through their life. And Arnold is one of them. And it just represents a long collaboration. And I'll read from this section. We first worked together in 1975 when he was competing in the Mr. Olympia bodybuilding contest in South Africa. The 1975 Mr. Olympia contest was the basis for the movie Pumping Iron. Arnold is the center of Pumping Iron in every way. He's the guy everybody else has to beat, which they pretty much know they can't. And as a character, he is aggressively, if charmingly, self-confident, witty, intelligent, full of himself. He somehow makes what is a rather freakish scene seem almost normal, although it never seemed normal to me. Steroids were legal then, and I had just spent several weeks on tour with the Rolling Stones, where Mick Jagger was the male sexual ideal. Being around all those super pumped up guys made me feel like Diane Arbus. In the movie, Arnold says, "I got the feeling that I was meant to be more than just an average guy running around, that I was chosen to do something special. I was always dreaming about very powerful people, dictators and things like that, or some savior like Jesus." Well, 10 years later, he was the Terminator. I shot him for the Vanity Fair Hall of Fame in 1988, and we were shooting on the beach, and he said he had a horse, and I said, "Well, bring it along," not thinking much about it. And, well, I couldn't believe it when the horse showed up. It looked like Arnold. Arnold's thigh in those white pants looked like the horse's thigh. It was not a picture that I liked right away because it's primarily about form, and I'm reluctant to have form impose the meaning on the picture. But in Arnold's case, form is also content. By the end of the 90s, Arnold was a successful businessman and was becoming a political figure. And when I photographed him in Sun Valley, where he has a house, he was just about to turn 50, and his body had changed. He had trimmed down, lost weight. When we went up on the mountain for the shoot, he didn't want to take his shirt off. He said it was because it was freezing up there, which it was, but I think it was because he had decided not to rely on his body to sell himself. This next section is a small section on dance, and my mother was a dancer, and some of my most vivid childhood memories are of her dancing on the beach, striking poses, and so I've always been enamored of Barbara Morgan's relationship with Martha Graham, and really loved, you know, I mean, they knew each other for over 60 years, and it was just a great collaboration. So when Baryshnikov asked me to come down to Florida for a few days to work on the beginnings of the White Oak Dance Project, you know, I said, "Well, can I come for longer?" And I went and stayed for almost 3 weeks and did a series of portraits and worked on reportage with the making of a dance that Mark Morris was working on. This is... I look at this picture now, and I think digitally I could fix this. You know? He was insistent upon doing that. It was really frustrating because I actually really wanted to see the Venus, but we could reshoot, I'm sure. This is a small section on the making of the Demi Moore pregnant picture. And then there's a section on performance artists, and of course, this is Cindy Sherman, really a wonderful artist. And I'm going to read a little bit from the back of the book about one of the questions about how do you make people do things that they do. And I'll read a little bit from there. "I think the only form of seduction I'm capable of is the assurance that I'm a good photographer and that we're going to do something interesting. I've never asked anyone to do something that didn't seem right for them, and I don't ask them to do something for no reason. There's always some thought behind my pictures. I throw out several ideas and see what the subject wants to do. When I photographed the performance artist Rachel Rosenthal, for instance, I gave her three or four ideas. Well, the last one was about being buried in the sand in the desert, and that's the one she got excited about. We actually went ahead and did that picture. It's not in the book, but we had to, we couldn't get a permit to dig a hole out in, on the Lake Mirage out in California because it was turtle hatching season. So we actually, we put our cars in a big circle and like a wagon train and basically, dug a hole, put her in it, shot the pictures, and filled the hole back up, kept all the dirt, and then left. I also sometimes ask a subject if they have ideas, and the portrait of Cindy Sherman was her idea. I just brought it to life and realized it. And this is, I met Cindy Sherman at her loft, and I asked her. I was very, intimidated by her because, obviously she photographs herself, and I was really at a loss. And I just thought, I asked her if she had any ideas, and she said she wanted to hide in the picture. And I don't know, it just popped in my head. I imagined, like those puzzles, like what's wrong with this picture? Like what's the different one? If we did 10, maybe we could do 10 Cindy Shermans. And so I hired a casting agent who found lookalikes. Years later, I was photographing Claire Danes, and the first time I met her, and she said, "Oh no, we've met before." And I said, "Oh really? Where?" She said, "Well, I was on the tail end of the Cindy Sherman picture, but you cut me off." So, it's a collaboration, especially if you're working with an entertainer, an actor, or a comedian. I never make people do anything, but I'm the photographer. It's a photo session, and a lot of it is about play. Painting the Blues Brothers blue, for instance, or giving a subject a role, a fantasy to act out. I'm interested in getting something unpredictable, something you don't normally see. Even so, when the picture starts to happen, it's often a surprise. This next section I had the opportunity in 1996 to photograph the for the Olympics, for the Summer Olympics, This is a very, very special picture, but it's sort of at the heart of what I, the responsibility sometimes of what I do, where, he was in a very certain place at this moment and at a special time, and it's really a privilege to be there at these places, in time for some of these subjects, I almost didn't go down to Texas to photograph Carl Lewis when he was training for the Olympics in 1996. He was a huge star, but he was old for an Olympian, 36, and he hadn't been dominant in sprinting and long jumping for a long time. When I got to Texas, I was astounded by the state Lewis's body was in. It was like a piece of sculpture. I'd photographed him before, but I'd never seen him when he was so close to competing. His body was fine-tuned to a point that would be impossible to sustain for very long. It wasn't just that his body was strong and beautiful. He had reached a mental and emotional place that you knew he would never reach again. A few weeks later, Carl Lewis won the gold medal in the long jump. It was a stunning, brilliant performance. He retired the following year with 9 gold Olympic medals. Charles Austin, who actually went on to get a gold medal also for high jump. Then there's a section in the book about these siege pictures or war pictures for Sarajevo that I took. And it's really more the idea that after, working so long with many assistants and lights and equipment, it's good every now and then to just break away, take your camera, and just go off and by yourself and do something on your own. So you only can yell at yourself if you expose wrong. So Susan Sontag had gone to Sarajevo, and I was inspired by her going, and I followed. Uh, I'm not a journalist. A journalist doesn't take sides, and I don't want to go through life like that. I have a more powerful voice as a photographer if I express a point of view. Portrait photography is liberating. I feel free to play with the genre. Photojournalism reportage is about being an observer, about seeing what is happening in front of you and photographing it. You don't tamper with it. The last picture in this series is actually a photograph from Rwanda. It's not up yet, but... It sort of segues into the O.J. Simpson trial. The O.J. Simpson... chapter is really about how we're all in this together. It's that High School Musical song. what I mean is that I remember coming home from work and the O.J. Simpson trial was on. It was like our first real reality miniseries on TV, and I was looking at it, thinking, oh my God, what a circus! I'm so glad I don't have to go shoot that. You know, I'm glad I'm not there. And then I get a call from Tina Brown, who was doing The New Yorker at the time, saying, would you go out and shoot the O.J. Simpson trial? And I was like, oh, Christ. But it was really an interesting, set of pictures in the long run. So I included them as an example of sort of this mini story. Being well-known can work against a photographer. If people are curious about what you're working on, it's pretty much impossible to cover a story by unobtrusively watching it unfold. You become part of the story. But then there are times when being well-known opens doors that would otherwise be shut. And one of the most flagrant examples of special access for me was the O.J. Simpson murder trial. I used to joke, because I was embarrassed about it, that I was born to cover that trial. I had trouble getting press credentials for the trial. I don't remember why, but it turned out the judge, Lance Ito, was a fan of mine and wanted to meet me. I went to the judge's chambers and talked to him about what I wanted to do and asked him to sit for a portrait, and he reluctantly declined. But when I told him I couldn't get a seat in the courtroom, he said, well, this is my courtroom and I can let in anyone I want to. So once I had access to the courtroom, I was able to meet all the people who wouldn't answer their office phones, and like everything else in L.A., the whole system depended on who you knew. Robert Shapiro, the lead defense attorney, was very helpful. He negotiated with O.J. for days about sitting for a portrait in jail, but O.J. was worried that he wouldn't have the right clothes. Then we were going to do a picture in a room behind the courtroom, but O.J. was worried about having handcuffs on. Finally, Shapiro arranged for O.J. to turn around and look at me when he was walking out of the court. And that opportunity seemed to be falling through also, however, when O.J. realized he was wearing a blue suit that day, and he didn't think he looked good in blue. And I pointed out to Shapiro that it would be a black and white photograph. That calmed O.J. down. So no one was supposed to take pictures in the few moments when everyone in the courtroom rises and files out, but I managed to get two or three frames. They reprimanded me, but they didn't take the film away. This is a nice little story about Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon. And, you know, as we were working to... We were sort of doing an homage to Some Like It Hot, and before they even finished their getting dressed or, you know, putting on their makeup, I realized it was the process that was more interesting. And the next section is about photographing Patti Smith over many years, and... these two pictures that you'll see here have about almost 20 years in between. And then I have a section on fashion, just so that if I was having problems sort of holding on to reality, I sort of lost all all sense at this point. It's like gone. But everyone loves being photographed for Vogue, and not just because of the magazine stature in the tradition, but they know they're going to be taken care of. They're going to look good. They don't have to worry about about someone, what someone's going to write about them. It's not exactly investigative reporting. This was part of a shoot with Kirsten Dunst right after she finished Sophie Coppola's film on Marie Antoinette, and the magazine had asked several designers to be inspired by Marie Antoinette, and this one designer, I call this the garbage bag dress, you know, going out. But I was so worried that, I mean, Versailles had opened their doors to let us shoot there, and I was just worried if they saw this dress, they were going to throw us out. So I actually did, it was the very last shoot, the very last day, you know, at the end of the day. There's a section on a set of news I did of the dancers, actually, from the White Oak Dance, from Mark Morris, actually, which I ended up using these pictures for the Pirelli calendar in the year 2000. This is a section, this is my section on groups. And how group shots are made. Some pictures attain a meaning as documents of their time, and that's certainly true of the photograph of George Bush and several members of his administration taken early in December 2001 for the cover of Vanity Fair. There was a 16-page portfolio inside with portraits of the president, Laura Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, John Ashcroft. I don't know why they agreed to let us do this. We were in the White House for 2 days setting up equipment and shooting, and I suppose they felt more self-righteous and confident than ever at that point. The war in Afghanistan was working. Kabul had just fallen, and as we now know, a few days earlier, Bush had initiated secret plans for the war in Iraq. It was a heady moment for them. I didn't direct this portrait very much, except to ask the president to put his hands in his pockets. He's a cocky guy with a Texan swagger. This is the Herbert Allen Sun Valley Retreat in 1997, another group shot. And then, of course, The Sopranos. This is a small little section on presence and charisma, which really talks about the Hollywood... about Hollywood portraits, Hollywood portrait photography, basically. One of the oldest cliches is that the camera loves certain faces and certain, and I resisted, talks about how I resisted this idea for a long time. I sort of always came ready with an idea to the shoot, and then I reluctantly, over the years, have come to have to believe that the cliche really is true, that some people are photogenic. This is a section I titled Being There. As much as I love pictures that have been set up, and as important as those pictures are to me, I'd rather photograph something that occurs on its own, real moments. The tension between those two kinds of photographs is at the heart of what I do. It's not a conflict, but sometimes it's useful to remember that things are happening right in front of you and that you don't have to complicate the situation. You can take what's given to you. I photographed Philip Johnson at the Glass House pretty much by accident. I'm interested in architecture. Houses fascinate me, and the Glass House, which Johnson designed and built for himself in 1949, is certainly one of the most important houses in the world. I was given an appointment to visit the house. I drove there one weekend. It never occurred to me that Johnson would be there, but he was. Well, this was frustrating. I knew that I should be sociable, but I wanted to study the house, so I was a little grumpy. And he was a little grumpy, too. He had assumed that we would chat. Well, I kept saying, oh, you can go do something else. And I walked around kind of rudely, taking pictures. I did have one small conversation with Johnson, though. I asked him how the air system worked. He looked at me like I was nuts. He said, Annie, you just opened the doors. Crossman, I guess. William Burroughs. Agnes Martin. I've often said that I don't have a favorite picture, although as time passes, the portrait of my mother taken one summer at my house in upstate New York when she was in her mid-70s. Means more and more to me. All right. It's probably my favorite picture. Oh, boy. It's honest, and my mother's looking at me as if the camera were not there. I use this picture of Sarah to talk about the smile and how you know, for many years, I never asked people to smile in my pictures. Because I guess, you know, as I grew up, I was always told to smile. You know, like, mothers always want to see their kids, you know, smiling. They want to make sure they're happy in these pictures. So I began to not believe in the smile, that it was real. You know, when you have children, you realize there are real smiles. And this is the last sitting with Susan Sontag in Paris for the book jacket regarding the pain of others. And then we have a section on the Hollywood portfolio for Vanity Fair done in 2006. And it's really, I didn't run all the pictures, but I used this section to talk about the beginning use of digital work. And it's a very exciting time in digital. And that's not Helen Mirren. We have to this is like, we gotta work out a better pause between those endings there. This is a section on the Queen and the making of these Queen Queen Elizabeth photographs, and it was going to be the last section of the book, but as it turns out, there were two more chapters, you know, added, and we'll talk about those. But it's really sort of this session really is dissected in detail. So because it was one of the last photographs I had taken when I started to write the book, and so it's really taken apart in detail. And I'll read a little bit from this. The Queen is the most photographed woman in the world, but I'd never looked at photographs of her with the idea that I would be taking her picture. The people at the palace were concerned about what I was going to do, and to alleviate their fears, I began saying that Cecil Beaton was my point of reference. A few people, including the Queen, would tell me that I had to find my own way. I kept thinking that somehow I would get the Queen outside in the gardens behind the palace, although I had been told that that was not going to be possible. It was so beautiful out there. I began thinking about what Beaton had done. He brought flowered backdrops into the palace. I had never really noticed the backdrops before. They sort of go out of focus. I realized that I could do something similar digitally. I decided to photograph the garden and the trees behind the palace for a backdrop. The morning of the shoot, the Queen came walking down the hall very purposely. She was definitely a force. This was all being taped by the BBC for a documentary. I would never have agreed to them being there if I felt I had any choice, but they had been following her around for months. Their microphone picked up her saying, "I've had enough of dressing like this, thank you very much," as she marched down the hall. And later, when segments of footage for the BBC were edited for a promotional film, it appeared as if the Queen were stomping out of the photo shoot rather than going into it. The Queen was about 20 minutes late, which we thought was a little strange. She had a tiara on. Well, that was not the plan. It was supposed to be added later. The dresser knew that. The Queen started saying, "I don't have much time. I don't have much time." Well, I knew how tight everything was, and I asked if she would remove the tiara. I used the word crown, which was a faux pas, and I said that it looked a little dressy. And she said, "Too dressy? What do you think this is?" And I thought she was being funny, English humor. But I noticed that the dresser and everyone else who'd been working with her were staying about 20 feet away from her. Well, right after we finished, I went up to the press secretary and said how much I loved the Queen and how feisty she was. And later I mentioned to a couple of friends that she had been a bit cranky, but it was nothing unusual. What was remarkable about the shoot, and I wrote the Queen a note about this later, was something the BBC missed: her resolve, her devotion to duty. She stayed until I said it was over, until I said thank you. So that was going to be the end of the book, and then I was on the road, of course, with Obama, and I don't know, call it instinct or whatever. It was just something was in the air. Something was, you know, it was. I just had a sense, a feeling about it, and I wanted to end the book with Obama, and so I wanted it to be sort of a beginning. So I use this chapter, and I talk a little bit about what it's like to be on the road working in politics. But then I was reading through the book. We were about ready to let it go, and I just felt it was missing something else. It was really missing somehow there needs to be an explanation about what was unexplainable. You know, like that there is a lot of stuff that goes on you can't explain. And I decided to, I went into the office and talked to Sharon Delano and said, I want to do this. And so here it is. I have a small but carefully selected collection of vintage photographs, pictures that mean something to me. And one of them is a black and white picture of a two-lane highway stretching through the center of the photograph until it disappears into a flat horizon. The highway was the route families took west, looking for work during the Depression. The picture was taken by Dorothea Lange in 1938 when she was traveling around the country for the Farm Security Administration. It makes me think of the story Lange told about one of her earliest field trips. After spending a month on the road in Southern California, she was finally heading home. It was raining. She was exhausted. She had a long drive ahead of her. She had been working up to 14 hours a day for weeks and was bringing back hundreds of pictures of destitute farm workers. Somewhere south of San Luis Obispo, she saw out of the corner of her eye a sign that said Pea Pickers Camp. She tried to put it out of her mind. She had plenty of pictures of migrant farmers already. She was worried about her equipment and thought about what might happen to her camera in the rain. She drove for about 20 miles past the sign and made a U-turn. She went back to the sign and turned down a muddy road. A woman was sitting with her children on the edge of a huge camp of makeshift tents. There were maybe 3,000 migrant workers living there. Lange took out her Graflex and shot 6 frames, and one of them of the woman staring distractedly off to the side while 2 of her children buried their faces in her shoulder. The image of the woman and her children became the most important photograph of Dorothea Lange's life and the iconic picture of the Depression. When I'm asked about my work, I try to explain there's no mystery involved. It is work. But things happen all the time that are unexpected, uncontrolled, unexplainable, even magical. The work prepares you for that moment. Suddenly the clouds roll in and the soft light you long for appears. Thank you very much. So I've answered all your questions in my book, so your questions are going to be good tonight. If you have any questions, they better put you on the spot. But I was asked to tell you that there's a microphone that will come running to you. Go ahead. Yes. Back. I might be able to hear you.
Thank you very much. How the horizon and the figure relate in so many of your photographs?
Well, the horizon is a wonderful sense of perspective. I was a painting major at the Art Institute before I went into photography. I was a terrible painter, and the book talks a little bit about how at that time in the late 60s, and Vietnam War was going on, in the painting department, there was, abstract expressionists, and they were very angry. So You know, if you were young, you didn't want to hang out in the painting department. So, to answer your question, I know that I was taught at the Art Institute a lot about using the frame for the whole picture. You know, composition is very important, and I learned to use the whole. What you see through the camera is you use the whole frame of the negative. And whether it's a square, a negative, or a rectangle, or, whatever, I use the whole frame. I thought it was when Hockney did his study on perspective, and he did all those collages. I mean, it was so mind-boggling and so exciting to me, because I thought, God, that's really how the eye sees, because we really see on this side and this side too, and his perspective studies were just extraordinary. And I started playing around with the camera, also just swinging it. And I talk about this in the book about putting two frames together and just shooting to the left and shooting to the right, and you just get a little bit more. And then digitally, seaming them together. I'm sort of back to one frame now. Thank goodness. Whew. Sometimes the right frame would be doing something and the left frame would be doing something else. And it really, I don't think I would call it photography. I sometimes feel more like a conceptual artist using photography, more than a photographer. I mean, it's so, what I hope to show in this book is how it can be used in so many ways. But that didn't answer your question either, so. Okay. Let's go to this side. I'm trying to give the microphone person a real workout.
I'd like to know what equipment you use to shoot your family and friends at home. What do you grab and pick up and use?
That's a good question. All the work in a photographer's life was, most of it anyway, was done, I had a Leica with shooting black and white, but I'm trying to find a small, like sure shot kind of camera now, and for digital, and I'm finding it very hard to find something that I like. And I've actually just recently taken home one of the. There's a new Nikon It's actually more full size, but it's not the top of the line one, and I've been lugging it out. I'm not happy with what I'm using right now. I'm still trying to figure that part out. I don't like the small little. I've been trying all those small little digital cameras, and they just don't. First of all, they're a little slow the way they sort of recycle, and so I'm still trying to figure that out. I've pulled the Leica back out again, but I'm actually really liking the digital so much that I want to try to make the digital work. That's good. Okay. Yes.
I wanted to know how your daughter was and whether or not she showed an interest in photography, and if she does, what kind of pointers are you trying to, transmit to her?
I thought when I had my children that they would be with me all the time on the road, but you learn very fast they have their own lives. So, it's just a scramble for me to get back home, I do, we talked about having a camera at home, but the reality is, especially since photographer's life, I think I've been taking a bit of a break, and when I'm home now, I'm really with them, and I'm not really taking pictures, as much as I should be. I wish I was taking more, but we have some snapshot cameras around that they play with every now and then. But there's no kind of, real push to that. If anything, there's a lot of drawing. I always leave out paper and pencils and crayons, and prefer for them right now to be drawing. Oh, yeah.
I love all your work, but my favorite work is the book about women.
Oh, thank you.
And my favorite photographs in that book is the photographs of the Las Vegas showgirls.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about how that book came about and especially how those photos came about? I mean, they're truly amazing. I don't want to give that away, but I hope everybody can get a chance to see the showgirls at home and in their costumes.
It was interesting. The showgirls are not in the in this book, and they were on the board to maybe be put in the book, but it's just the book would have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. But the women's book was really Susan Sontag's idea, and I was looking for an idea to work on, and I wanted originally I thought I wanted to make it international, like a bigger book, and it was Susan who said to me, "If I were you, I'd stick in a state of America. That's what you know. don't look like an idiot going to other countries trying to photograph the rest of the world. So she insisted that it was such a brilliant idea to stay put. It's just when you do work on a project like that, you feel like you're just starting. I mean, and when you sort of finish it and it has to go to press, that's when you start really seeing great people, great women for it, but it sort of had a little formula where there were very famous women and then women you met on the street. That was the whole idea. There was actually a homeless woman in Miami that lived in the bathroom. That was an interesting. The showgirls was actually the nucleus, the beginning of what I thought. That's when I thought I really could do the book, and it was actually done for Tina Brown for the New Yorker because she wanted to do a special issue on women, and she asked me to shoot those pictures. And I thought about shooting the Las Vegas showgirl, and I went out to Las Vegas, and I met the women. The night before, at Bally's and all the, I think there were a couple of casinos that I went to meet them, and they were all in their regalia and in their costumes, and so we all agreed to meet the next day, and they were staggered, and when they came in, and they weren't in their costume, I just looked at them, I couldn't believe it was the same person. It was just unbelievable. And I just said, before you put your costume on, just let me photograph you, just the way you are. And it was just so how they sort of became, they dressed up to be women, It's like, it was just extraordinary. It was really an amazing set of pictures. But they need each other, you need both of them. Is he holding up, everyone? Should we go? Okay.
Good evening. Other than your mother and some special photographs of Susan, which is your very favorite photograph?
Well, I didn't even want to stake the claim on the picture of my mother being my favorite because when you do this for so long, what gets exciting, and I've always said this, is the body of work. That you have all this work, and it's astounding even to me. I just when I look at it, it's exciting. That's the most important part, the body of work, and how it all goes together. So I don't really have, I get pushed in the corner about what's your favorite picture, and so I finally, the thing about the picture of my mother is it means so many things to me because. It's something that I can't do in my everyday work. It's a raised bar picture to me. It's like something that, you can't expect to do in your everyday work. This idea of, it's the closest I've come to, I don't believe in like that you can go get the soul of anybody, but it's the closest I've come, to it. And so, but I don't, I kind of laugh when I hear people say, "Oh, you really captured that person." I say, oh, I've got such a small little, look at them. I mean, I have a teeny moment, and we're not going to get those special things except for with the people who we know and we love and who know and love us or or we have a very, I mean, I think my favorite photographs of all time were Stieglitz's photographs of O'Keeffe. You know, those are like, I mean, I just get weak in the knees. You know, she didn't mind being photographed. She loved being photographed. She loved being his muse. And they loved each other. And so, those nudes are, they're so powerful, you know. It's like amazing. Better than Weston's, I think. Yeah. Yes.
I noticed that in many of your photographs, they are very tightly cropped, where the heads are touching the top of the picture. And, of course, the borders suck you into the picture and create a sense of intimacy. Could you just explain a little bit more about that compositional element?
I think we talked a little bit about that over there when we were talking about how I use the frame and try, you know, to really use what I have, use as much as the negative as possible, and it's really that's all it is. There's the Mamiya has they don't have a good enough digital back right now. I'm trying to get them to get a better one. But the Mamiya with a 140 lens on it, now is such a beautiful lens because it could feel a little wide, but yet it was like a normal lens. It was like a little bit longer. I couldn't believe it was considered a long lens because you actually could, depending on where you stood with it, you know, you could make it feel wide. And so, you begin to sort of look at you begin to know your lenses and what they can do, and you do try to come in close. I'm actually, trying to get a little closer as I get older. I think I have that little old ladies thing where everything looks farther away. You know, it's like I do. It's like I keep thinking things are going to hit me. So in my pictures, anyway. I think you guys should go home. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.